Hello, my name is Anthony Horowitz. I've written two James Bond novels, and you're listening to Honour Her Majesty's Secret Podcast, the home of Silver Hands. It sounds like a character in a Bond book.
And welcome to another special edition of On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jared Albrecht, the yard sale artist, and I'm very excited to introduce the latest in our series of Bond bonus podcasts that we'll be calling Special Podcast Interviews, or SPI, or SPY for short. On this SPY episode, Alan J. Porter and I are thrilled to bring you our latest interview with 007 author extraordinaire Anthony Horowitz. Mr. Horowitz was kind enough to share some time with us, so without further ado, here's about half an hour with Alan J. Porter, myself, and the amazing Anthony Horowitz.
First off, we're delighted to welcome Anthony Horowitz, author of the recent James Bond continuation novels, Trigger Mortis and Forever and a Day, to the On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast interview show. It's great to have you on the show, sir. Thank you very much for making the time. Just to sort of kick things off, I was just interested how the Music of Bond event went last night at the Albert Hall, and did you enjoy presenting it?
Well, I was sort of nervous about the whole thing. I was almost dreading it, to be honest with you, but actually, from the moment I arrived, it was quite wonderful. It was the most amazing concert. The Royal Philharmonic Orchestra were fantastic, and the two performers, Matt Ford and Alison Jaya, were just incredible. And of course, the Bond music is so good. You know, to hear 25 films one after the other, you're reminded how much music contributed to the films and really made them and molded them, and how important they are to the whole franchise. John Barry's genius up there all along. And, you know, I was giving the commentary from the side, and I've never spoken to such a big audience before. 4,500 people were sitting in that room, and it was like nothing I've ever done, and it will stay with me for a very long time to come.
Wow, 4,500. That's a lot of people. Did you know it was going to be that many when you agreed to the gig?
Well, I know how many people the Royal Albert Hall sits, so I guess it would be quite a big crowd. But, you know, it only hit me when I walked in there before it all began and just saw these seats that went on forever, all the way up to the heavens and to the horizon and all around me. And it's just this extraordinary building. But it suddenly hit home. And then I had like 2 minutes of terror. Shall I get on a bus and say I've fallen ill? Shall I call someone for help? What do I do? But then I done a lot of work for it. It meant reading about every single one of the films and preparing material for it. And it went really well. I mean, you know, the audience just loved it. And why shouldn't they? It was spectacular.
That's great. Yeah, I was lucky enough to go to the Casino Royale event at the Albert Hall a couple of years ago. And that was an amazing evening. So I can only imagine hearing the whole Bond suite in there would have been a great evening.
Sitting next to an orchestra in that environment.
Wow, you obviously have a passion for the music. So given that evening that you just had, do you have a favorite soundtrack or score to one of the Bond films that stands out to you?
It's funny you should ask that, because if you'd asked me that a week ago, I would have answered without any hesitation at all, Goldfinger. Okay. It's always my favorite song, and I still love it. But then, you see, last night, I heard Skyfall being sung and hadn't realized what a wonderful song that is and how enjoyable it is and how true to the spirit of the early Bond themes. But also, Live and Let Die is a big favorite of mine. And I made a big speech last night about The Spy Who Loved Me, because Marvin Hamlisch's wonderful track for that song, which follows one of the greatest ever Bond stunts, you know, with the Union Jack parachute, is also a wonderful piece of music. So I'm afraid my answer has become more difficult. I mean, it was Goldfinger was definitely number one, but now it's sort of having to fight off the competition.
That makes perfect sense.
It definitely got the best lyric of any Bond song, which is why I like it so much. I love the rhyme of a Midas touch with a spider's touch, and Shirley Bassey belts it out so well. It is a great song.
Yeah, it is probably the quintessential Bond score, isn't it?
Some of the beats of it and some of the climaxes are recaptured by Skyfall. It's got that same sort of return to those crashing chords that Barry had himself introduced. So, I mean, it was all the music. If you ask me, I tend never to be negative, but there are very, very few Bond films that didn't have great title songs.
Very true, very true. So talking of Bond sort of related events, I recently heard you on the Bletchley Park podcast in relation to their James Bond exhibit. So what's the connection between 007 and Bletchley Park? Because I don't remember him sort of visiting there in any of the books or anything.
I'm not sure. Well, I don't think the character ever goes to Bletchley Park. I mean, obviously Fleming is involved in naval intelligence. I don't know. I should know, but I don't know if he himself went there, although I imagine he must have been fairly intimately involved in some of the work that they were doing, even if it was happening in Room 39 down in London. I was there because there was an art exhibition at Bletchley Park of Bond imagery and images, and we launched my new book up there. And I should be able to give you a better answer as to sort of the connection between the two. I'm afraid you'll have to go on the internet, or some of your listeners, I'm sure, will provide you with that.
I'm sure somebody will jump in and give us the information. So that was the sort of launch event for Forever and a Day?
Yes, it was. I think it was the very first event that I did. Although we didn't actually launch the book there, it was, as it were, the first day on the road with the book. I gave a little talk there about Bond and also about Bletchley, because having written Foyle's War for so many years, you know, I was fairly well acquainted with the work they were doing and Enigma and all the rest of it.
Yeah, excellent series, by the way. One of my favourites. So we sort of have a few icebreakers that we've sort of already started chatting, but just some basic Bond questions we tend to ask each of our guests to sort of run through those.
We do.
What's your first memory of Bond? Sort of how did you get drawn into the James Bond universe?
Well, that would be 1962, Dr. No, the movie. I still have the tie-in book, which I bought after seeing it. And I remember being absolutely blown away by pretty much everything in that film. I don't know how long an answer you want, but basically I was stuck in a pretty grim boarding school in North London. I was miserable. It was grey. The food was horrible. There were no women there. It was an all boys school. There was a matron, but she only just, I think, managed to sort of slip female. This was adventure and excitement. It was so cool. It had Ursula Andress. It had beaches. And I loved it. And then I read the book after it. I was quite young at the time. I was about 8 years old, but still loved the book. Then began to read Bond. And my greatest love has always been the books rather than the films. I mean, I love both pretty much equally. But actually, what I'm most connected with was written Bond.
Nice. Picking up some clues here, I think I might know your answer to this next question. Who is your favorite Bond actor?
Well, I'm afraid the answer is pretty obvious. It's got to be Sean Connery for me. I mean, it's, you know, ask anybody over the age of 55 or so. And actually, even a lot of children when I'm talking at schools still relate so strongly to Connery and to his performance, which I suppose they've seen on television at Christmas or whatever. Daniel Craig runs him a very close second in my view. I mean, I did love Casino Royale, but when I'm writing my own James Bond novels, it's Connery's voice that's always in my ear.
Nice. And which of his films is your favorite? Or if you have a favorite film that's not Connery, feel free to tell us it in.
I guess it's Goldfinger. It's close. I mean, again, Casino Royale was amazing, and I can remember the visceral enjoyment I had when I saw it. It was everything a Bond film should be, and it felt like a return to form after so many sort of misfires in a way. I mean, I've loved all the Bond films, so don't get me wrong. There are one or two that I've liked less, but by and large, I've always loved going to a Bond movie. But the one I'm going to go with as my favourite is Goldfinger. It's got everything. The best car, the best villain, the best sidekick, the best girl, the best whatever. It's just outstanding.
Absolutely.
And you sort of talked about the fact that your first love is the novels. Do you have a favourite Fleming Bond novel?
Yeah, again, it's difficult because I read them so often and I change as I get older. But I'd probably go for From Russia with Love. I think the construction of it is really interesting. The fact that Bond is such a late arrival in the book. The plot against him is so cleverly conceived. I love the characters in it. I love the world of it. It's got some fantastic set pieces. I think as a piece of writing and as a piece of quite mature, not sort of what you really associate with James Bond writing, which is to say it's slightly more somber and sober than some of the other books, slightly less, you know, larger than life. I think that probably is my favourite.
Okay, it's good. Yeah, I think it's excellent. Actually, Majesty's is my particular favourite, but I have a whole backstory around that too. So,
well, you see, I've never terribly liked that book. I've always thought the plot utterly sort of incomprehensible. You know, it's sabotage the whole of England's or Great Britain's agriculture and all the rest of it. Do you really need to brainwash attractive women to carry germs in that way? I mean, why not just hire people, do the job. It struck me as a very complicated way of achieving a fairly simple aim. But that's just my view. And they're all the Sir Hilary Bray stuff, I don't know.
We'll agree to disagree on that one. I do live from Russia as well.
Yeah, one of the great things about Bond is, you know, you can talk endlessly about these things, about which is your favourite and why, and which ones don't work for you and why. And I think it's just the genius of the material, but it's so rich. There's so much in it to discuss.
I'd agree. I think every one of the books in itself is a different experience, even though it's a series. Most of them stand well on their own. And as you said, there's so many different tacks and things that Fleming took, and so many sort of subplots and character development within each of the novels that you can discuss each of them at depth, or the whole series at depth.
He himself was experimenting with the, you know, I think when I read the books, I was thinking that Fleming was stuck with a formula and he didn't want to be a formulaic writer. And so he takes risks, like, for example, famously, The Spy Who Loved Me, where he tries to sort of break the formula and do something completely different on Her Majesty's Secret Service too, and for that matter, The Man with the Golden Gun, a real sort of departures from the sort of the classic Bond formula of the villain, the mission, the investigation, the confrontation, and the resolution, which is sort of defines, I think, the great Bond novels.
Yeah. So talking of villains, which is your favourite Bond villain? And what is it about the character that sort of makes him the best villain?
You know, I'm very interested by your use of the word him in that question, because I'm afraid my answer to your question is Rosa Clare. I thought about this hard and long, this question of who is my favourite villain. It could be Goldfinger, it could be Hugo Drax, I think he's brilliantly drawn. But I just love Rosa Clare. I always have done. I mean, you know, the fact that she was played by Lottie Lenier in the film, and Lottie Lenier was a very considerable actress, married to Kurt Vile, you know, a serious player, and yet she takes on this part. But in the book, the chapter where she tries to seduce Tatiana is just one of my favourite chapters in all of Bond. You may remember she comes in wearing orange crepe de chine. Even that description makes me smile. And Fleming describes her memorably as the oldest and ugliest whore in the world. And so unknowing, she thinks she's beautiful. She's put lipstick on, she's got chocolates, and poor Tatiana is sitting there dying a thousand deaths. And it's just one of my favourite chapters, and it makes her my favourite villain. And actually, cut forward to Venice and the fight in Venice, all the gadgets in the Bond films, the sort of the knives popping out of the shoes, still makes me smile. So I'm going to pump her Rosa Clare.
That's really good. Really interesting.
I like
Very
that.
Cool. Yeah, me too.
Some would put her as a henchman, but I think she could be a villain because she was a lot of the plot.
He is the head of the KGB. I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, the villain of that book, who would you say? Is it Mad Grant? Is it the head of Smirsch or whatever? I mean...
Yeah, it's confusing.
It's not she's given the control of the operation, and I'm going to say she's a villain, definitely not a hench person.
I would go for that. But speaking of the hench people, which one of those is your favorite?
That's easier. It has to be Oddjob.
That's one we get a lot. I think that is an easy one.
Who else would you put in there against that? And also, of course, you're talking to somebody who is very immersed in the books, so I'm not going to be tempted by Jaws or any of the other characters who appear only in the films. You know, you're talking to somebody who is pure Fleming here, so the choice is more limited in a way. No knick-knack either, or any of that sort of thing. Oddjob is the perfect henchman. I mean, he doesn't say a word, that's the first thing. He's gloriously racist now. I mean, you couldn't create a character like Oddjob anymore, you know, with his cat-eating habits and all the rest of it. He's, you know, the bowler hat, which incidentally I have worn. That's another thing, a feather in my cap, or rather a bowler hat on my head. When Doug Jackson out in New Zealand, he had bought an original Oddjob hat, which he let me put on, which is sort of a great moment for me to actually put a Bond prop on my head. His death is memorable, you know, in the film. You may know that Harold Sakata got quite badly burned when he was doing it, but didn't let go because he didn't want to spoil the shot. What a pro. Professional wrestler as well, Olympic professional wrestler. And I've always thought him an interesting actor. Oddjob was sort of the culmination of his life in a way. It was sort of the high point of his acting career. His death is so wonderful. Whether you look at it in the book, he's sucked out of the airplane window, the Stratus plane window. In the film, he's electrocuted, but both deaths are so spectacular. He's great.
He really is. And moving into a whole other realm of spectacular, who is your favorite Bond girl? And in our interviews, we always allow our person to pick two. If you like, you can pick one for character and one for more of those, you know, surface level reasons. So,
well, let's get the surface out of the way and go for Pussy Galore.
All right.
Pussy Galore, who appears in Trigger Mortis, is obviously my favorite of the heroines for her name, for her background, the way she falls in with Bond. So after having been a gay woman for all her life, you know, one meeting with Bond and suddenly everything changes. Again, you couldn't possibly get away with that now. But I just love her. And I love her also, let's be honest, for Anna Blackman's portrayal of her in the film and the fight in the hay and all the rest of it. And that's a surface one. But, you know, if you want my favorite Bond girl, I'd go to the opposite extreme and go for Gala Brand in Moonraker. Yeah. I've always thought her very interesting and liked her very much. You know, she is a special branch policewoman. When she first meets Bond, to say that she is frosty is understating it. I think there's a line in the book, something like the ice of Gala's reserve melting in the summer sunshine, something like that. I love the fact that she has this sort of flirtation with Bond that doesn't actually go the full hog, as it were. And then that wonderful scene at the end when they're both badly hurt in the book. I mean, first of all, the cliffs of Dover fall on them. And then, of course, they get almost scalded to death in the belly of the Moonraker. and they meet at the end. And that scene is so sad, where she tells him that she's actually meeting somebody else and that it's not going to happen. And I think that's what makes her so interesting. She's not your sort of Bond girl. She is a woman in her own right. And so she is probably my favorite female character.
Very cool.
Very cool. Yes. You mentioned that you're sort of a diehard Fleming Bond, the books. And obviously you sort of watch and enjoy the movies, but do you enjoy any of the other Bond media, such as dabble in things like the comic books or the board games or the video games or anything like that? Any sort of other iterations of Bond catch your attention occasionally?
Games broadly don't interest me at all. Anyone. Comics, I've seen one or two on the wall. After I finished my last book, the Fleming Estate very kindly gave me an original cell from the Daily Express strip of James Bond, which goes back a few years. And I love having that here. And I have glanced at some of the recent comics, but no, I'm not. I am a bit of a purist, I'm afraid. I start with the books. I love the books, then the films, and that for me is enough.
I have to ask, do you know who the artist is? Is it a John McCleskey piece of artwork, or is it Havok? Do you know?
Havok.
Okay, Yorick Havok. Okay, cool. That's my thing. James Bond in comics is my
I should have to look at them more carefully.
What was the road that sort of led you to being asked to take on the Bond continuation novels?
For some reason, I'm not wild about that phrase, continuation novels. I'm not being pernickety here. I was mentioning it en passant. Actually, I'm being pernickety. What am I talking about?
I just find it interesting because that seems to be
When I write a novel, a James Bond novel, I think of it as an original novel. I mean, I suppose it is a continuation novel, but it's just a mindset thing. I mean, it's a case of being inside the world rather than continuing it. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it does. That's interesting.
Filling it out. It's a filling out novel or something of that sort. The road that led me to being asked to take it on was, you'd have to ask Ian Fleming Estate that, because what happened from my point of view was that when Sebastian Fuchs was asked to do it, Devil May Care, I was jealous. And then when Jeffrey Deaver followed up, I was annoyed. When William Bond continued with Solo, I was really getting very, very touchy indeed. Because I kept thinking, why weren't they asked me? I mean, I'm on record as being, a major Bond fan. I've grown up with the books. Alex Rider, my own spy, the teenage spy, I've always said was inspired by a sense of James Bond getting too old. Why can't he be a teenager again? Hey, that's the light bulb moment that changed my life. So the Fleming Estate were well aware of me as a writer who wanted to write Bond, but never rang me until finally they did. I did have a bad habit. I do a certain amount of journalism. And in pieces that had nothing to do with James Bond, I would mention the fact that I would love to write a book one day. So even if I was doing a travel piece on Vienna, it would somehow pop into my copy, please ring me and let me do a James Bond book. And finally they did. The call came from Corin Turner, who works with the Fleming Estate, and we had lunch together, and I was suddenly on board as the fourth writer, which was fantastic. It was what I'd wanted to do for years.
Excellent. So you're sort of running your own guerrilla marketing campaigns to say, let me write.
I could say that. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Wonderful. The one thing I really love about your two novels today is you're unique in the fact that you're actually including some unused Fleming material, and they're set firmly within Fleming's continuity. So where did that unused Fleming material sort of come from, and was that your idea, or was the IFP who asked you to do that?
It was IFP. It was their idea, and I was very lucky because it was after William Boyd had finished. And instead, I want to say that having been jealous of the three writers, I did enjoy all their books, all three of them, different ways. However, the new material that was found, Fleming, as I'm sure you know, was involved in a television version of James Bond towards the end of the 50s. I think that TV series was killed by the sale of the films. But in developing the television series, possibly for MGM, he wrote at least five, because I've seen five which have never been published. He wrote a number of story treatments. Now, some of those stories were he eventually used himself in For Your Eyes Only, and possibly the other collection of short stories too. I don't know. But what I do know is that the estate found five unused stories, of which the first, Murder on Wheels, I included in Trigger Mortis, and another one, Russian Roulette, which is by coincidence the title of an Alex Rider novel. I didn't know that it had already been used. Appears in Forever and a Day. The first of those story treatments was quite extensive. It was 10 pages long. It had dialogue. It had M and Bond and Tanner. My favourite scene, incidentally, in all the films, always, was the briefing. I loved Bernard Lee. I also loved Judi Dench as M. And for some reason, those scenes just always gave me a warm feeling that I knew where I was when Bond threw his hat onto the hook and walked into the meeting with M. So for me to have the real thing written by Ian Fleming and to be able to put it into Trigger Mortis meant that even if 90% of the book was terrible, 10% of it, you know, that scene would be great. It would have actual dialogue, M speaking with M's voice as written by Ian Fleming. So it was hugely useful and a big boost to my confidence to write the book. Forever and a Day, the Russian Roulette chapter was much skimpier, much thinner. It was much more of an outline and tells this story about a Russian submarine and the captain who wants to blow up a casino. A story which, incidentally, Fleming later said in his book Thrilling Cities was true, though I have never found any other reference to it.
The way you integrate them into the stories is very seamless. I mean, they flow within the existing plot very nicely. Did they influence your story outline and your plotting around those Fleming pieces?
Yeah, I mean, I chose Murder on Wheels because it was the strongest of the stories I had in front of me out of the other treatments. But also, it occurred to me that Bond had never been involved in Grand Prix racing in any of the Fleming books and only briefly in one of the films. And therefore, it was a really interesting virgin territory for me to explore. Plus, of course, it's very glamorous, very dangerous, very fast and very exciting. So it was great to do it, but it meant that the whole of the first part of Trigger Mortis sort of is a little bit of a detour away from my main plot, which involves space travel. That said, I loved doing it. It was very enjoyable to write. I drove some Formula One cars and I went to the racetracks that I described and sort of tried to get a feel for the whole thing. It did take up quite a big chunk of the book. For the second story, because the story was thinner, it was an obvious choice because of the setting, Monte Carlo, which is where the book is set. And I used it as a story within a story. In other words, Bond actually tells the story to the character 16 inside the casino. And I quite liked that because one of the traits in a James Bond novel as written by Fleming is storytelling. Characters tell each other stories. So, for example, in Casino Royale, Bond has quite a lengthy passage where he talks to Mattis about his own, you know, apprenticeship and how he became 007. Obviously, all the villains, Dr. No and Drax and all the others, have their wonderful chapters where they tell their life stories before they fail to kill Bond, which is now sort of a standby of the films and the books, and it has become something that I think Fleming sort of more or less invented, this sort of amazing showdown. And one of my very favourite Bond stories, not known to many people, I think, is A Quantum of Solace, which is a story told very much in the sort of Somerset Maugham sort of genre world, where Bond is only involved as a bystander. He's at a dinner party and hears this story. So I like the sort of act of storytelling because I think it is part of Bond's world.
Excellent. You know, my friend Alan here, if he has anything that comes close to his love for Bond, it has to be for auto racing. So you probably almost killed him with excitement in that novel.
I'm very happy to hear it.
I was totally jealous that I believe if I read the acknowledgements right, that Nick Mason actually helped you with the research too.
So. Nick Mason owns the car.
Yes, he does. Yeah.
Chapter. Absolutely right. His collection of cars is jaw-dropping. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. But it was, as I say, to actually sit in the car as well. And then his son-in-law drove me round Nürburgring, which was, you know, an experience I'll never forget. Sports, it wasn't in an actual racing car, it was just a sports car. But my God, he took those corners fast and taught me everything about sort of how you have to attack a racetrack. And Nürburgring itself is amazing and dangerous and unique.
Yeah, very much so. Yes, I really did enjoy that.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear it.
Knew that you would.
Okay, folks, quick interruption to thank our Patreon sponsors. These are the folks who are helping us pay the bills, and we greatly appreciate it. So without further ado, here are the folks that are making it happen. Brendan O'Dwyer, Christopher Burleson, Joseph Fine, Brandon Sisson, Phil Amthor of WeHaveDonuts.com, Susan Trawick, Ben Spooner, Stephen Thompson, Chris Usher, Justin Bean, Steve Trawick, Richard Stevens, Valiant Hermes, Jacob and Robin Fleming, Clay Henson, Auburn Tiger Talk, Ann Congian, Catherine England, George Gaston, Will Summerford, John McCune, Tom Anderson, David Evers, Andrew Barber, Timothy, Steve Harlan, Dan Thompson, Wes Agginson, Rich Reimer, Gerard Albrich, William Glenn Matthews, Joel Beckham, David Hegler, Mickey B, Hugh Anderson, Shane Bailey, Matt Robbenheimer, Mick Vigicana, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, Tony Perry, Alex Wynn, Josh Teal, David Simpson, Earl Ricks, Mike Finley, C.T. Wayne, Michael Kirshner, Dave Powell, Chris Camo, Darren Pyle, Chris, Wardam Wade, Jason Albrecht, Randall Walker, Ben Amos, Joshua Corbett, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Patrick Williams, Rob Morgan, Steve Schuster, James James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Rains, Nicholas Craig, Russell Milling, Matthew Wagstaff, Joey Miller, Mark Squire, Dave Medinas, Spanky, Brant Rumble, J.W. Rice, Michael Morton, Lawrence Kane, and our one-time and anonymous donors. We couldn't do the show without you guys. We greatly appreciate it. While I've got you on the line, I have to highly recommend a couple of things. Alan J. Porter's book about James Bond and comics called The Illustrated 007 is available on Amazon.com. So if you have not checked out The Illustrated 007, is a fantastic book about James Bond and comics, head over to Amazon and do that. And while you're there, maybe pick up a couple of these books from Anthony Horowitz. He's got his Alex Rider series, along with his James Bond books, Trigger Mortis and Forever and a Day. Go get those books and make your life happy. Now, back to the show.
Speaking of all this great insight into your writing, what about the actual process of when you're writing your 007 novels, or if it's different from the other novels that you write? Do you have a particular place, music selection, ritual? Do you like to be alone? Like, what's your process when you write these books?
I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint you. I don't play John Barry in the background, if that's what you think.
That's what I was hoping. No,
I never play music when I'm working, or very seldom, because it interferes with my thought process. You know, to be honest with you, the process for writing a James Bond novel is pretty much the same as everything I write, which is, in a single word, it's immersion. You're talking to me at this very moment in my office in London, which is in Clerkenwell, and I spend an awful lot of time here at this desk, and I pretty much plug myself into my work, and the rest of the world disappears. So for Bond, the only difference is that before I start writing, I reread all the books a whole lot and make notes and sort of try and remind myself of the various tropes that Ian Fleming uses and how he creates scenes and how his dialogue works, all that sort of stuff. So I really immerse myself, first of all, in his books. By the time I start writing, I've obviously done a lot of work on my own treatment and sort of, you know, the structure of my book and everything. But when I actually sit down to write, I use a fountain pen rather than a computer for the first draft. It's just a case of hiding inside James Bond. Writing a Bond novel is a fantastic privilege because you really are an insider. You're inside the world now, looking out rather than outside looking in, which is the reading process. My job, I guess, is to be invisible, to remind myself always that Ian Fleming was a master. I mean, he was a brilliant originator, but also a brilliant stylist and writer. The Bond novels have something very special going for them in their language, in their set pieces. I mean, look at one of my favorite moments, the bridge card game in Moonraker, which is sort of, how do you make a game of cards exciting? But it is. It's one of the most fantastic chapters of character and tension and hubris and destruction. It's brilliant. And every time I read it, it makes me smile. But then again, there are those chase sequences like the one in your favorite on Her Majesty's Secret Service, the bobsleigh chase. Is read it. It's so brilliantly done. Or Goldfinger, the circular saw in the book, where, you know, it's approaching Bond, getting closer and closer and closer. What's going on in his head? The psychology of it, the sweat, the terror, the anticipated pain. You know, this is brilliant writing. And my job is to try to do something almost as good. To do something as good, I know, is not possible. But to do something that gets close is what I'm trying to do. And that is simply an act of total immersion.
That's fantastic. Fantastic.
Thank you. I think you actually sort of partially answered this with the previous answer, but sort of what's the best thing about working on Bond and what's sort of the most challenging thing about it for you?
The most challenging thing in a way is having to stop all the time. You know, I write a shirt, I write a pair of shoes, a car, a hotel, a drink, an attitude of any sort. And it's not just a question of working out, did this exist in 1952? Is it the right whatever? But also, what would Bond think of it? Would he be impressed by it? Would he like it? Or would he sneer at it? Because Bond, although he's not a snob when it comes to people, is very much a snob around objects. And so the biggest challenge, I think, is simply that. It's getting it right, getting the attitude right. Because Bond's attitude and Fleming's attitude is so very peculiar, and it's often not my attitude. And the best thing about working on Bond is everything else. I mean, I love writing these books. They're not easy. They are challenging in many ways because, as I say, the standard is so high. But, you know, as a Bond fan, an uber fan almost, there is nothing better. There is nothing you can do that is better than that. I mean, maybe to appear in a Bond film would be pretty cool, or to write a Bond film, or to, I don't know. But for me, writing a book is as good as it gets.
Excellent. So talking of the books, and I don't know if this is a spoilerish question, because I certainly know that Jared hasn't read Forever and a Day yet, because it's not actually out here in the US.
I won't listen. Let's go ahead and talk amongst yourselves.
So in Forever and a Day, was there a specific reason for not naming the previous holder of the 007 designation?
There is a small spoiler there. I mean, yes, I mean, in the book, we're looking at how Bond becomes 007. And I do suggest that before he was 007, somebody else was 007. And it's a rather peculiar thing in the book that when I name the spy who was 007 before James Bond, I just draw two lines. Now, this is something Ian Fleming did, by the way. He occasionally, when he talked about real people, did not put the name in. He just drew a couple of lines and left them anonymous. So I'm following in his footsteps in that. But I'm sort of glad you asked the question, because the answer is that the reason I did not name the first holder of that designation, 007, the first 007, was that it felt like sacrilege to do so. There is only one 007, and that is James Bond. And if a writer, a continuation writer, to give him his full terrible title, comes along and suddenly says, well, actually, there was Bill Smith 007, I think you've broken faith with Ian Fleming. I think you've broken faith with the readers, and something is wrong. So although some might say that even to suggest there had been a previous 007 is itself sacrilegious, I didn't at least give him a name.
Oh, thank you.
That's a fantastic answer.
I'm glad you asked the question.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you. And I completely agree with you that, yes, I think it would break faith with the mythos and the legend for anybody else to have that tacked to their name. So,
if you want a piece of vandalism, I like the fact in Forever and a Day, I have actually added something to the gunmetal cigarette case that Bond carries in every single film and every book. And from now on, or from the future, whenever he opens that cigarette case to have one of his Morlun with the three rings, a little bit of me has been sort of graffitied in there.
Yes, I love that. And I also love the, without spoilering, the story of why he ended up smoking those cigarettes as well. It was excellent.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Now that you guys have had your fun, the poor American who hasn't got a chance to read it yet, we'll let you take a step out of the 007 world here for a minute. What non-007 work that you've done are you most proud of, sir?
Probably Alex Rider, The Teenage Spy, which has, sold a lot of copies in both England, Britain, and in America, and has made all the difference to my career. It was my first really big hit as a book. It was inspired by James Bond, although I did everything in my power to make Alex as different from Bond as I could. But I am particularly proud of it, I suppose, because so many young people have come to reading through the Alex Rider books. I hear it over and over again from teachers, from parents, that their children didn't read and now they do read, and Alex Rider is the reason. And as somebody who values reading and values literacy now perhaps more than ever, I am proud of the fact that I have managed to help, even if it was inadvertent. All I did was write stories. But if I may have two bites of the cherry, so to speak, I'm also proud of Foyle's War, which is a series that I worked on British television, and it's also been shown in America for 16 years, and a Second World War detective series that dominated my life. Writing it was a labor of love. It does have a very faint James Bond connection, because the star of the TV series, Michael Kitchen, also turned up in at least two, possibly three Bond novels, playing Bill Tanner opposite Judi Dench. So there's a connection for you, but I'm proud of Foyle's War too. Again, one last thing, it was produced with my wife, so that also makes me smile. And both of my sons have appeared in it as extras in one way or another. My youngest son is in the very first episode.
Oh, that is quite awesome. Very cool. And are you currently working on any projects that you are at liberty to speak of that you have maybe coming up on the horizon?
I'm adapting a very famous American book for television, Caine Mutiny by Herman Woke, which is a passion project of mine for many, many years. It's a wonderful novel of the Second World War, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a huge New York Times bestseller. It's been filmed with Humphrey Bogart years ago, but not, I think, as well as it might have been. It was a play on the stage with Charlton Heston, and I want to do it justice as a 10-part television series. So I've started work on that. I'm also writing a new series of books away from spies at the moment. I'm in the world of detectives. The Word is Murder was the first book in a series. The second one, The Sentence is Death, comes out in Britain in November and will be in America soon after. The Word is Murder is already with you and has done really well. These are a sort of quite tricksy Agatha Christie-style murder mysteries with a real twist. And I plan to do about another 8 or 9 of them, and we'll start number 3 probably next year.
Oh. Oh, excellent. My wife is actually an Agatha Christie scholar and collector, and she just finished The Word is Murder, and she loved it. So.
Oh, I'm glad for that. I hope she recognised my knowledge of the great Queen of Crime.
Yes, she certainly did. And talking of which, I think that Trigger Mortis and Forever a Day are certainly among the strongest, I was going to use the C word, but strongest new Bond novels, let's put it that way.
Whatever you want to call them, I'm not really that fussed. what it's worth, my own favourite of all the Bond novels not written by Ian Fleming is Colonel Sun, Robert Markham, or Kingsley Amis under a false name. I thought he nailed it. I'm never sure about the torture scene at the end of that book, but otherwise, for the sort of language, the flavour, the shape of it, the plot, and Colonel Sun himself, the character, I don't think anybody actually has beaten Robert Markham.
It is an incredibly strong, really good one. You mentioned earlier that there was sort of five unused scripts, so are we looking at seeing volumes 3, 4, and 5 of the Anthony Horowitz?
It's too early to answer that question. I haven't been asked to do one yet, a third one. I think the publisher would be very happy to do a third. Speaking for myself, I don't know. I have an idea, and that's sort of always interesting, that it seems to me that a trilogy would be somehow quite rich and satisfying, and as I say, I've got quite an interesting thought in my head. So it's a question, I think, of wait and see. We need to see how the book does in America. We need to see how the soft cover does over here. It was a number one bestseller, which was a good start. Watch this space.
We will, with interest. I hope it comes together because I really enjoy them.
We are very kind. That's kind.
Okay, I think that was sort of the last of our questions. And thank you for your time. It's actually been really good and really enjoyed having you on the show and some really illuminating answers. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you guys. Thank you very much for your interest and for your kind remarks.
And thank you for your time as well. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. This was awesome. Thanks for doing it.
Have a good rest of the day.
And thank you. Sir.
Now, how great was that? Anthony Horowitz, great writer and super nice guy. I want to once again give my thanks to Anthony for being on the show. I'd also like to thank his assistant, Alice, who helped get everything lined up tech-wise, schedule-wise. Alice was huge and we greatly appreciate it. And of course, I want to thank my OHMS pod cohorts, Alan J. Porter, for taking the lead on this interview, and Pat Sampson from the Longbox Crusade podcast for all his editing help. Greatly appreciate that. Great interview. Go check out those Anthony Horowitz books. And keep in mind, on Her Majesty's Secret Podcast will return.